I'm David Thatch, and I'm an alcoholic.
I've been sober since March 9, 1992, and I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group in Spartanburg in the northwest part of our state. And I'm also currently serving as your Area 62 treasurer, and I want to take a moment to thank you guys for the way you've responded after the problems we had earlier in the year with the treasury. A lot of groups in this district came through and sent money in, and I was just really impressed with some of the little nice notes and things that I got to supportive things during a tough time, and I thank y'all for that. I'm here to talk about singleness of purpose today, and first thing I got to tell you is I'm not an expert. You know, I'm not here to give the AA opinion on any particular thing. I have done my research. You know, the first thing I did when Ingrid hit me with this was, well, first I worried. And I worried for a while, and then I went to the literature. And a lot of the literature I went to, just so you know where I've been digging, is one of them is one of my favorite books in Alcoholics Anonymous, is Language of the Heart. Phil W.'s Grapevine writings. I find more explanation and background on traditions and matters of AA policy in that book than I do all the others. The others are great, but I just love that book. And if you don't have it, grab it. It's a good read. Also, you know, went to the big book, an instruction manual. Always do that. And the 12 and 12 AA comes of age. As Bill sees it, has a lot of letters from Bill that are, kind of reveal a lot about his thinking behind a lot of things. And the pamphlet, Problems Other Than Alcohol, is to address the subject specifically. I also have a good dozen or more of Bill's talks that he gave to different groups or a general service conference. And when at all possible, I like to hear Bill tell me things, you know, and rather than just read them, and I found a lot of good stuff there. Another place, when I'm hunting for information on traditions and AA history and things like that, is there's a Yahoo group online called AA History Lovers, and these guys are very much into AA, and I can post a question, and if they don't know, they know where to look, and they can point me toward finding things too, and that's really helpful just for any of you that find yourself needing to look things up. You know, I thought we'd start with, you know, what is singleness of purpose? You know, I think one thing that goes on around singleness of purpose a lot, you know, sometimes I think we ought to use another language sometimes, because it's real often brought up in a real negative context, you know, that I don't like what you're doing over there and I'm going to beat you over the head with it, or it's usually in the middle of an argument, you know, and people get a bad misunderstanding of what it's all about. From what I know as a singleness of purpose is to do the very best that I can today to see that AA is here tomorrow for the alcoholic being born this afternoon, going to tread the same path I did. I'd like for it to be here when he gets here. And I'm making an effort to leave things at least as good as, if not better than I found them. You know, I'm doing my best to keep AA as AA was. And not always a popular place to stand sometimes, you know. I mean, AA members all have their own opinions on things, and we all come in involved in self and what we think is best, and everybody's got an idea, and it's not always real easy to stand on tradition, but I think it's very, very important because I'm so grateful that this was here when I got here, you know, and I want to do everything I can to see that it remains that way. And I went through a lot of things. I was trying to find, okay, what is the statement on singleness of purpose? We know traditions, and we'll get to them. And in Problems Other Than Alcohol, and incidentally, I've left some information here that any of you please feel free to pick up. It'd be a lot of stuff I've gotten info from and referred to. And I went into that pamphlet, and I'll just read what this is. As Bill says, now there are certain things that AA cannot do for anybody, regardless what our several desires or sympathies may be. Our first duty as a society is to ensure our own survival. Therefore, we have to avoid distractions and multipurpose activity. An AA group as such cannot take on all the personal problems of its members, let alone the problems of the whole world. Sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. Groups have repeatedly tried other activities, and they've always failed. It has also been learned that there is no possible way to make non-alcoholics into AA members. We have to confine our membership to alcoholics, and we have to confine our AA groups to a single purpose. If we don't stick to these principles, we shall most surely collapse, and if we collapse, we cannot help anyone. You know, and that's what I take to be what our directive is, sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps is what we're to be doing in our groups. I think I was reading a grapevine this month, and I saw an article that sort of implied that singleness of purpose was some new idea brought about with some recent prejudice against some particular group or another, and that just struck me as that's incorrect. You know, and I went back, and I think one of the best ways to understand the whole idea of why we came to wanting to stick to a single purpose is knowing a little bit of AA's history. I don't know how many people here study that, but I love it. There's a good reason that we're meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous today and not the Oxford group. And, you know, because we grew out of the Oxford group. It was in the early 20th century. It was a non-denominational spiritual movement. Their goal was to return to what they called first century Christianity, you know, as it was practiced in the early days when they met together, shared, helped each other, and that type of thing. And out of that grew our fellowship. You see in the big book the story of Roland and how Dr. Young tried to help him and couldn't, and he came back and found sobriety after some trouble, found sobriety through the Oxford group and their six-step program of recovery. And, theirs was recovery from sin. And, you know, it was all-encompassing. They included everybody. They were trying to save the world. That was one thing they were trying to do. But what had happened is they went up, took a little vacation, a couple of them, and Ebbie, old friend of Bill's, got in trouble again. He had done things like shoot up his house when pigeons were pooping on his new paint job to driving into a lady's kitchen and getting out and asking for a cup of coffee. And the judge had had enough. And they were going to lock Ebbie up for good. That's what happened to drunks back before AA. You went to the asylum and for the rest of your life. And some of these Oxford group members stepped in and grabbed Ebbie, and they said, you know, we can help him. And the judge said, sure, just take him out of our state, and you can have him. And so they did, and Ebbie got sober. Ebbie did what they do. You know, they had a few steps that they followed, and he did those. And one of the things they needed to do next was carry the message, and he thought of old drinking buddy Bill. And Bill was reaching his bottom. It was around November of 1934, I guess. And he was reaching bottom, sitting in the kitchen drinking, and Ebbie calls, and Ebbie came to visit. And Ebbie told him a little bit about what had been happening with him lately. You know, how things had been. He was about to be sent away, and these guys stepped in, and he had a program by which a person could find God in order to stay sober. You know, he kind of gave him that whole spiel that we give them. And Bill at first didn't sober up immediately. He drank on it a while and thought about it. But, you know, December of that year, around the 11th, he took what was to be his last drink, went in the hospital, and Ebbie came back and visited him, told him again of that program of action. And Bill did these things, and Bill had that experience that we read about in the book. He had that sudden, dramatic spiritual experience, and also with that had a vision of one alcoholic helping another, you know, because he had received help from an alcoholic, and his immediate thought was, you know, I can pass this on to another. And he got out, and he proceeded to try to help drunks, but what he tried to do was help them the way he got it, you know, that they better get right now. Better have a dramatic spiritual experience. And the doctor at that time that Bill was dealing with said, hold on, you know, talk drunk to a drunk. You know, don't get on with all this spiritual experience that they need to have. And he did that. So, you know, he'd heard that by the time Mother's Day of the next year, 35, rolled around, and he found himself in Akron on a business deal gone real bad, found himself in need of a drink. Or thinking about a drink, you know, looking in the bar, and decided to do one thing he'd always found helpful, which was talking to another drunk. And he called, made a number of calls, and met up with a guy named Dr. Bob S. And Dr. Bob S. was, at the time, he called too drunk to talk to him. And they arranged something the next day, and Bill came over there, and this doctor, he'd been through enough people trying to help him, and he said, I'll give this guy 15 minutes. And he ended up staying 6 hours that night because something happened. And, you know, what happened for Bob there and what happened for Bill is something that happens for a lot of us. I think I've got something in language of the heart I want to read real briefly where Bill says what happened for him when Ebbie came. He said, Ebbie told me a story, carefully detailing his drinking experiences of recent years. Thus he drew me still closer to him. I knew beyond a doubt that he had lived in the strange and hopeless world where I still was. This fact established his identification with me. At length, our channel of communication was wide open, and I was ready for his message. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough for Bill to buy into the idea that he needed to have a spiritual experience, but he knew this guy was like him. And if this guy was better, he knew Ebby's drinking. Ebby didn't have to tell a whole long story. They drank together. And what happened for Bob? Bob tells us in Dr. Bob's nightmare. He says, this was a man who had experienced many years of frightful drinking, who had most of the drunkard's experiences known to man, who had been cured by the very means I'd been trying to employ, that is to say, the spiritual approach. He gave me information about the subject of alcoholism, which is undoubtedly helpful. Of far more importance was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I'd ever talked who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he taught my language. He knew all the answers, and certainly not because he had picked them up in his reading. You know, and that's what we're dealing with when we're talking about drunks talking to drunks and concentrating on what we know is identification. Bill knew that Ebby was a bad drunk and was no longer drinking. He could see that. And he was much more open to the message that Ebby had to carry. Same thing with Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob had been in the Oxford groups for 2 years, longer than Bill. He had been praying. He had been prayed over. He'd been, you know, he'd had everybody in the world trying to help him. He was a doctor. He should know a little bit about this thing. But you know what happened was a guy that came along that had the same experience and didn't tell Dr. Bob what Dr. Bob had to do. He told Dr. Bob what he, Bill Wilson, had to do. You know, here's what I was like, and here's what happened, and here's what I'm like now. Thing we do from the podium every week. And established identification to where Bob could say, you know, I'm like that. And if I do what he did, maybe I'll get what he's got. And that's what happened. Dr. Bob didn't sober up immediately because he only wanted to do certain parts of the program, and Night Step didn't look too good. But after one drunk, you know, around June 10th, 1935, you know, he experienced, well, what a lot of us have to do, hit bottom, be willing to do all the steps, and he achieved sobriety. So, you know, what they had done was forward to the second edition tells us that Dr. Bob and Bill had discovered that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. You know, what they had realized is that this thing is first a thing of mutual help. You know, it's not just that I'm going to help you, we're going to help each other. I'm going to help me by helping you. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you about me. And I'm going to tell you what I had to do when we identify. Because all us drunks have been lectured to. We've had everybody from bosses and school teachers to mothers, brothers, and sisters all saying, you know. And what they found was one drunk sharing his own personal experience seemed to have some effect that could, what do we say, that the message that can reach an alcoholic has to have depth and weight. It has to be born out of personal experience, and I know that you know so that I can believe you because I'm a drunk and I'm naturally suspicious. I don't believe you normally. I need that identification. And what they did in realizing that, they realized that what they needed to do was work with drunks. They did begin to do their work in the Oxford group. You know, nobody could at that time say, go to AA. There was none. But they were both in the Oxford group. And what they did was begin to do one thing we see is begin to get down to a single purpose. They realized that they needed to focus on helping drunks. And what you had was what they got to call in the alcoholic squad of the Oxford groups. And they did Oxford group meetings, but on the side, they met with each other and they just worked with drunks. And they ran and grabbed them up and got bad drunks, put them up in Dr. Bob's house. Those guys would shinny down the drain pipe and run away and they'd chase them. But just did this over and again, you know. And you get the story of meeting with Bill D and what happened. Same thing. They went in and said, let me tell you about me. And he listened and got hope. You know, somehow that's what identification is that's how hope's born. Hope's born for me that way, I know. And they proceeded helping drunks, and they got a lot of flack because they were supposed to be helping everybody in the Oxford group, and these people weren't crazy about the kind of folks they were dragging into their meetings. You know, drunks tend to throw up on your carpet and stuff. And they caught a lot of flack, and they realized it was too important what they were doing to, you know, give up just to get along with the Oxford group. So in 1937, New York broke from the Oxford group. It was still two more years before Akron officially broke from the Oxford groups because they had some very close friends, close personal friends that loved drunks that they just hated to leave. But in this process, they realized, you know, we got something going here, and we need to record this, because when I tell you and you tell the next guy and he tells someone, it changes as it goes. And they wanted to make sure that the message wouldn't be garbled, is what the book tells us. And so they did decide to write a book. And one thing I think I found interesting in looking at our decisions to narrow our focus on this to helping alcoholics only, it was in writing the book. You know, the original manuscript they put together, they sent out to a lot of people to get feedback and hopefully, you know, big sales so they'd make a lot of money. But the original 12 steps said, having had a spiritual experience as the result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Now, they got that feedback, and the groups got together and yelled and screamed and did what we do in business meetings. And they hashed it out to decide what they really needed to do, and then result was the 12-step reading. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So, you know, at that point, they decided we had a single purpose, and they were going to record that in our literature so it wouldn't be changed, you know, so that would be passed on one to another. And shortly after, you know, AA began to take off. Saturday Evening Post published something that it resulted in just tremendous growth and tremendous problems, because AA was beginning to spring up out of what Bill called mail order groups, meaning, you know, they wrote and we sent them a book in the mail and a guy sobered up and did just what it said, you know, then went to another. And so they were even growing up without the experience of having any AA member experience while they were growing, and a lot of problems and a lot of ways of getting off track a little bit. And Bill saw this, you know, he knew it was becoming a problem. He's getting letters with people going, Bill, they're doing this, and, you know, tell us what to do. And at the same time, he got aware of, somebody made him aware of a prior movement called the Washingtonian movement. And Washingtonians were 1840s. It was a group of alcoholics, a few of them sitting around a bar in Baltimore going, you know, we really need to quit drinking, you know. And they made a pact and decided we're really going to quit drinking. Well, what happened was shortly after, you know, they began to tell their stories from the podium, and they began to sign up more drunks, and they quickly reached 500,000 members. 500,000 members staying sober. AA wasn't close in that period of time, you know, but 500,000 members, and they had one thing they were doing, was a drunk helping a drunk, signing up drunks. But what happened was they got a little bit diverted from that. Bill got aware of all the problems they had. And I'll read what Bill said. He said, their original strong and simple group purpose was dissipated in fruitless controversy and divergent aims. And then he goes on in an article he wrote in the 45 April Grapevine, when he's beginning to get ready to present some traditions to us. He said, we need to make everlastingly certain that we shall always be strong enough and single-purposed enough from within to relate ourselves rightly to the world without. Because he realized, you know, what happened was they started taking in non-alcoholics as members, receiving non-alcoholics on the podium, getting involved in politics, getting involved in prohibition-type issues, slavery, anything popular at the time, and they fell apart. And by the end of the 1840s, what was 500,000 members was none. You know, no one was there to help the next guy stay sober. And Bill knew we didn't want to end up with that same sort of thing. So shortly thereafter, April 1946, Bill introduced in the AA Grapevine, where he usually introduced things to us, what he called the 12 points to assure our future. And that was going to be our traditions. And what they basically were to define our single purpose, to help alcoholics recover from alcoholism and warn us away from all kind of activities that seem to get in the way of that. And he went around selling these, you know, because he had to sell. Groups, you know, aren't willing to change a whole lot. If something's going on like it is, why change it, you know? But he knew it was very important, important enough to run around the country and talk to anybody that could stand it about these traditions. And by 1950, he had finally sold him on the idea of a general service conference where we have members represent us to what's going on in New York nationally. And they got together in Cleveland because drunks in Akron didn't want to meet in New York, and drunks in New York didn't want to meet in Akron, and so they met in the middle. And like always, same kind of business meeting. And they met there, and they approved the traditions as, you know, something we believe to be good for AA and how we want to conduct ourselves. And also at that time, Dr. Bob was very ill. You know, he was dying of cancer at that time. And he wanted to say a few words to us, you know, things he wanted us to remember. And he's very, I love Dr. Bob. You know, it's just very simple, not too complicated with him. And as sick as he was, he wanted to give us a final message, the very last time he spoke to us. And one of the things he said was, let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Basically, you know, let's stick to our single purpose of helping drunks through the 12 steps and not bring so much outside philosophy into this thing. And it was important enough that, you know, he had to get up there and tell us. And we'll get back to traditions in a minute because we're going to talk about that. I'll hit the rest of some of the history around singleness of purpose, and by all means, it's not all of it. In the 1950s, we'd become real popular and began to be accepted by society in general, you know, that this thing worked. And we began to have all sorts of folks showing up that did not have an alcohol problem or had other sorts of problems going on. You know, we had decided in traditions that if you had alcoholism, you had plenty of problems. But, and what was happening, they were having a drug problem, something that's common you hear about today, you know, because there wasn't any NA. You know, these guys saw alcoholics getting better, and they wanted to get better, and they began to show up. And Bill had to address this problem. He did it in the AA grapevine, but it's reprinted in this Problems Other Than Alcohol pamphlet. And it was the February 1958 grapevine, and basically what it says is no non-alcoholic can be an AA member, that AA members may help non-alcoholics start their own groups that would not be AA groups but can lend assistance. An AA group must have a single purpose only, which is recovery from alcoholism, that there can be no such thing as a dual-purpose AA group, you know, alcohol and anything else. And members don't have to be pure alcoholic. They just got to have alcoholism, you know. And that should be well and good, right? You know, okay, Bill has put out this thing. Everybody ought to know this is how we do it, and not in AA. You know, sometime later, around 1970, we had a problem because all these strange sort of people started showing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. These folks they called hippies. And people were upset. They're writing Bill going, these people are showing up and they look weird and they, you know, and they do drugs and they have free love and all this, you know, just a lot of stuff, you know. And Bill was getting these letters and he finally, you know, he was writing people back and they finally published one in the Grapevine in 71. Just a letter on the hippie problem. And, where again he said, you know, to be a member they only need to be alcoholic. They may look weird. They may have other problems. We found that a lot of weirdos have come into AA, and they've yet to hurt us, because if they get sober, we tend to change them. Said they don't have to conform to anything, but they do need to be alcoholic. He also stresses the importance of identification in there. And in addition to that, he also stresses that, you know, no non-alcoholics can attend open meetings. Maybe they'll find something they can use to start their own group. They cannot share in the open meeting. You know, they won't be received on the platform. And what else do you have? Just the basic stuff there, you know, that we're talking about. It's very important for us to keep alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we can lend our steps to anybody. We can assist on the outside, but we don't lend our name to things that aren't single-purposed, you know, things that aren't Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that ought to be well and good. Is in the grapevine again. Maybe everybody read it and everything got better. No, not in Alcoholics Anonymous. During the 1980s, you know, we had treatment center boom. It got real popular to get sober. And insurance started paying for this time and again. And a lot of people, growth in Alcoholics Anonymous was huge. Growth of groups was huge. People were being poured into AA at a tremendous rate. And what was happening there, too, you know, was... That's where we got the drug is a drug is a drug. You know, counselors telling people it doesn't matter what you got, go to AA because it works there, you know. And we had a lot of stuff come in real fast in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it created a lot of problems, enough so that it came to the General Service Conference a number of times. Got thought about. End result is what you got was this blue card in 1986, which is not conference approved literature. It's what they call a service piece, meaning, you know, it's a good idea, but we haven't done conference approval on it, and groups can use it or not. And it's what you usually hear at a lot of meetings is, you know, this is a closed meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, kind of stating our purpose, our single purpose, asking all who share to confine their discussion to alcoholism and that kind of thing. And so all should be well and good. We got that taken care of. No, you know, it's the conference theme this year was, you know, singleness of purpose, the cornerstone of AA. So it's still an issue. And probably, you know, will always be because we can't seem to, as alcoholics, leave well enough alone. And do what we do best, we got to do something else. And I want to share something. I don't know if it's real important, but I got to thinking. I said, you know, I've read a lot of stuff about how well AA had been doing, you know, how well AA is doing. And I said, well, how well are we doing, you know, in the last 10 years? And I just took, and in the United States, I'm not looking at where AA went into Russia recently and what they do is run around 12-step drunks, help them, and they grow, you know. But how are we doing where we've had it a while and all we got to do is look in the phone book and show up to a meeting? And you know what I found was between 1994 and 2004, the growth was less than 0.5% per year. That we only, in that period of time, gained 56,511 members in an 11-year period. These are estimates. We don't, you know, count noses all over, but I have no reason to believe they estimate any worse now than they did 10 years ago. That we're showing, you know, 56,511 additional members in 11 years. That's the growth that's shown in the United States. Last 5 years, we've experienced 1.7% growth, or 0.3% per year. And that's 20,241 additional members. That's one additional member for every 57 members that were sober 5 years ago. So, you know, I mean, when I'm talking about something like tradition, singleness of purpose, that kind of thing, I got to ask myself, you know, is that as well as I think we can do? You know, is that good enough? You know, that for every one of us sitting here today, 5 years from now, there may be one additional member? Or should I take a look again at, you know, what I'm doing in AA and what my group's doing and how I'm conducting myself? And are we really fulfilling AA's primary purpose, which is our singleness purpose? So we move on to traditions, you know. And what tradition are we talking about, basically? Tradition 5. You know, that each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, that of carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I use long form of traditions. They're a little more revealing sometimes of the intent. And that's telling us what we're about, to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. You know, what's our message? You know, what is our message? We ever give any thought to that? I'm going to suggest that it's what I read earlier, sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of our 12 steps. You know, that's probably it.
Can you say that slowly?
Yeah, it's in this one here, and I'll get you a copy of that. Freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of our 12 steps. The 12 steps. Yeah. And then what other tradition are we talking about? Tradition 3. Our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that, as an AA group, they have no other affiliation. Yeah, that defines the group we're talking about above, you know, in Tradition 5. Tells us what's required there. So we've got, like, some requirements. There are a lot of suggestions in AA, but we've got a couple of requirements to be a group. Is, first of all, we're going to include all who suffer from alcoholism. You know, that to be a member there, you're going to have to be alcoholic. You know, that we can't exclude anyone who's alcoholic. Any two or three gathered together only for recovery from alcoholism may be a group. That's only. That's not in addition to anything else. And also, you know, let me just move on. We'll get back to that. I get excited about it. I'll try to settle down. And some of the things are pretty interesting about the tradition, though. I want to share a little background because, you know, I see sometimes where we may defend singleness of purpose and forget that the only requirements that a person be alcoholic, it doesn't matter what else they've got, and they may have 400 other disorders or none, and that sometimes we need to do our own inventory. Sometimes defense of singleness of purpose may be a thinly veiled prejudice against some other group of people that just doesn't happen to look like me, act like me, or may have some other problem. And I need to do my own inventory on that. 1937, you see in the 12 and 12, it talks about in AA year two that a man approached AA and he said, I suffer from an addiction far more stigmatized than alcoholism. You know, will you have me? And the answer being, after some debate, they didn't just go, oh, yeah, you know. Well, the story gets mixed up with another and gets mistold a lot. And I think sometimes, we need to hear what it was really about. The addiction he had was sex deviant. And I got that from Bill Wilson's talk. And basically, Minnie was gay. At that time, that was considered a sickness. It wasn't as we are today. And he's basically saying, I'm gay. I auditioned to be an alcoholic, and will you have me? And that was not an easy decision for them, and they talked about it. And then end result was an older member, they say in the book, that was Dr. Bob, said, what would the master do? And he was welcome into AA and became a good member and was very helpful to others joining AA. Now, in 1945, at the Clinton Street Clubhouse in New York, same sort of thing happened. You know, a guy showed up who, he was a black fella wearing a blonde wig, a dress, and makeup, described himself as a dope fiend, and said, can I come in? And, you know, Barry L. and these other guys that were at the club went, what is this? And they called, well, they squawked about it for a little while. Then they said what they always do, let's call Bill. And they said, Bill, here's what we got. And Bill's answer was, did he say he was alcoholic? And they said, well, yeah. And he said, well, I think that's all we can ask. And the guy was welcomed into AA. He didn't stay very long, but he was welcomed to AA. Those two stories get tangled up a lot, but, you know, he had a lot going on. You know, at that time, there was a racial problem where black members weren't necessarily welcome everywhere. Certainly cross-dressing black members, and certainly cross-dressing black dope fiends. But he was an alcoholic who wanted to recover. So that's why, you know, we have that tradition. Why is it important we have a single purpose? I'd say that's unity. Tradition one, our common welfare comes first. Alcoholism is something we can all agree we have. We may have many other things and maybe helped by the 12 steps, but there's one common ground we choose to meet on, and that would be alcoholism and recovery from alcoholism. Another thing to think about, tradition four also, you know, talks about my group and how my group ought to be living by the same principle of tradition one. It's a small part of the great whole of Alcoholics Anonymous too, and I need to consider how my group affects Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. That's one of those things. All the things say a group can do what they want if, you know, it doesn't affect Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And a lot of what we're going to talk, you know, we talk about here is a matter of group autonomy. Bill has said over and over again, a group has a right to be wrong. Doesn't mean you're right by doing different. He said you can be wrong if you want to be. As a group does very often have a choice over how they conduct their affairs and do as they see fit. And if they think they're doing right and they're getting results, great. If they're not getting results but they still think they're doing right, okay. But sometimes we depend on John Barleycorn to run through and thin them out, you know. But a group can do what it wants. What are the other traditions about? They're warning us about things that get in the way of our singleness of purpose. These things are basically money, property, prestige, authority, and outside issues. You know, there's maybe a little bit more to it, but basically that. Money, your tradition 6, 7, and 8. You know, they warn us about taking funds from outside. Why? When I take money from somebody outside, they may have input into how I do this, you know, and that interferes with my single purpose. They warn against collecting too much money for no stated AA purpose. You know, what happens when we get way too much money? We got to worry about money. You know, we got to talk about money. We got to argue about money. Money becomes a focus, and we forget about the drunk that doesn't know yet. For no stated AA purpose, you know, that really says a lot to me, is I want to know that every dollar in the hat is doing the best it can do to help an alcoholic get sober. And, you know, a question then we always have to ask ourselves if we're taking our own inventory as a group member, you know, or any individual in AA is, you know, am I doing all I can to see that every dollar in the hat is in some way going to help a drunk who's still suffering? You know, is my group doing that? Am I doing that as an individual? One more tradition is 8, and it warns us that we should never be paid for helping drunks. you know, that there's no professional 12-step work. Obvious reasons. Property. Tradition 6 warns us that an AA group shouldn't own property. And it gets a lot into clubhouses and that kind of thing where, you know, most things exist. And saying that these things, when we do have something, should be entirely outside of our AA group conduct. Why? Gives us something to argue about. Gives us something to focus on other than helping a drunk stay sober. You know, if I let all the club business or meeting place business creep into my service committee, how much time am I talking about carrying the message to jails, detoxes, homeless shelters, places like that? Now I'm worrying about who left dishes in the sink, place is dirty, utility costs are high, turn the air conditioner down. This is personal experience. I've been involved in some of this. And it gets very hard to talk about, you know, just helping a drunk get sober. And so he's doing all he can to warn us over and over again. You've got a yellow sheet on that type of thing. You've got it in your tradition really spelled out. And he's writes about it in the language of the heart a time or two, that can be something we really need to watch out for. A question to ask myself in my own inventory as a group member or home group itself is, you know, are we allowing club business to come in and interfere with our service committee business? You know, are we diverting too much time, energy, money, and stuff into the maintenance of our meeting facility rather than our actual 12-step work, you know, and how we conduct our meetings? Authority. Authority and prestige are kind of similar, except prestige is more this idea of AA celebrities and gaining status and personality above principle, where authority is more like government and ability to punish and that kind of thing. But a lot of the same traditions apply. You know, tradition 2 is warning against government. It's saying that we're trusted servants. You know, you guys here are serving your group. You're not ruling your group. You know, and boy, if you think you are, go back and tell them. You know, it's past gonna be. Tradition 9 suggests a spirit of rotation. That means, you know, just about time I get brilliant, they move me on, you know, and it keeps us from having people seated in power and ruling our groups, which just leads to problems and bad feelings. And tradition 12 reminds us that humility ought to be our guiding principle, that we should humbly serve, you know. The prestige thing, the same thing. Trusted servants, rotating leadership, also anonymity at the public level. You know, that we're not out there trying to be the voice of AA. Because while I'm trying to build my own ego and I'm trying to make you think I am somebody, I'm not helping that drunk over there in the corner who's suffering. You know, I need to remember that. And I need to just be grateful I'm here. I ain't nobody. Well, you know, one thing to ask ourselves, you know, are we practicing rotating leadership? You know, are we keeping the same people in a job or are we rotating these officers? Whether or not there's somebody to rotate in, you know, are we rotating those old ones out? And do we practice a true group conscience? You know, is the majority of our group involved in the decisions we're making as a group? Are we trying to involve a loving God as he may express himself through our group conscience? You know, this is a spiritual thing. It's not just a vote. You know, are we doing all we can? Are we, like, prayerfully making decisions for what we think would be best for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole and what might best help the guy who still suffers? I don't do that all the time. You know, I have to take my own inventory. Then the other thing, outside issues, which takes in an awful lot, but, you know, Tradition 6 warns against linking ourselves to outside agencies, whether they be hospitals, detoxes, the prison, anything we're doing stuff, you know, the clubhouse we meet in, that, you know, we want these two things separate. You know, we don't want to take on the identity of the church that my group happens to meet in. You know, we're not the Baptist primary purpose group, you know. We are our own group. That's why we pay rent. That's why we, you know, we stay out of their business. Sometimes they try to creep in, and we just have to very carefully explain that when we can. So we ask ourselves again, you know, are we allowing that business of our meeting facility to creep into our service committee? You know, am I doing that? Is my group doing that? Tradition 10 warns that no group or member, and I'm talking about long form, you know, should ever express an opinion in such a way as to implicate AA on any issue outside of what we do or single purpose. It says group or AA member, you know, I have to bear that in mind. It's not just talking about somebody else. You know, outside issues they were particularly concerned about at that time were religion, politics, and prohibition, alcohol reform, you know, but then there's a great deal more. falls into that. I want another question to ask myself, and we need to ask ourselves, is does discussion of outside issues in our meetings give the newcomer the impression that AA has an opinion on medicine, legal advice, the police, things like that, you know, a lot of things we discuss. Does that give the newcomer an impression there is an AA opinion? A lot of times we like to say, I'm not the opinion of AA, but many times, you know, I come across as the opinion of AA. That's what we got there on traditions. We got like problems with singleness purpose. Now, when I get done here, we'll open up for some questions and that kind of thing. I'm going to run through some that I hear a lot. You know, some of the problems we have, closed meetings, a lack of respect for closed meetings. Opening a meeting as a closed meeting just by saying we're going to have a group conscience and let's vote now. How's that like a well-considered, well-informed group conscience when half the group's not there and didn't know you were voting and we opened the meeting? And what does that do for the alcoholic that needs anonymity at a meeting? I have a personal example of a school teacher showing up to a meeting that got opened up for somebody's kids, only to see kids in her school sitting right there. Our closed meetings, what we read on the blue card, you know, are we doing what we say? Is it closed? Identification comes up all the time. That is the ANDA. That's the alcoholic ANDA. That's the cross addict. That's the anything. You know, anything that's not just our straight-up identification of, you know, one alcoholic talking to another. That comes up all the time. Outside issues, some of the outside issues discussed in meetings. Politics, law, financial advice, marital advice, you know, medicine, you know, what y'all do with your medication. Some of the genetics of alcoholism, some of the psychotherapy that goes on, some of what I heard on Oprah read in Dear Abby this morning. Somebody's inner child and all that goes with that. That was popular a little while back. Thank God. That's kind of dying out a little bit. Drugs. Staying clean. You know, drug addiction. All the, you know, using, staying clean, all the language around that. You know, doesn't have a whole lot to do with alcoholism as we practice it here. Dual purpose special interest groups. I've lumped those together, you know. Special interest groups are men's groups, women's groups, homosexual groups, lawyers groups, you know, things like that. Okay, what does the tradition tell us? If they open the doors to all who want to recover from alcoholism, they may consider themselves a group. And if they don't, they're not. You know, pure and simple. If I'm a member of one of those groups, do I open the door to any alcoholic seeking help? If so, I'm in tradition. If not, I'm not. I have to live with that. What about dual purpose groups? There are none. You know, tradition tells us there's no such thing as a dual-purpose group in Alcoholics Anonymous. Talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and we were talking about examples of this. And, you know, I'm a bass fisherman. I love to fish. And guys in my group do, too. And if we decided, okay, we're going to have the bass fisherman's group, all right, that might be good. Now, you know, we could be a group if we welcomed everybody, whether they had a boat and a rod and reel or not. You know, you're welcome. You can come on in. And we could be a group if we discuss only alcoholism. But if we get to talking about, okay, you know, what time we're going fishing and where, and we get to plan everything around that, we got a second purpose, and we're no longer a group. And, you know, there's a lot of things pop up in AA like that. Some of them, you know, that were tried a lot and Bill refers to in problems other than alcoholism is, alcohol pill groups, you know, that we're going to work with alcoholics and addicts, and that would make us no longer an AA group. So, you know, I got to take a look. You know, what am I doing? Is it sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of our 12 steps? And joint fellowship functions happens in a lot of places. An AA-NA dance, anything, an AA-Al-Anon thing. Things that apply affiliation with another organization other than Alcoholics Anonymous, those occur at times and just don't work with our traditions. You know, some of our club business we've already been through. You know, are we careful to keep our group separate? Keep our group separate from the place we meet. You know, I'm darn sure going to make sure that my group stays separate from the Baptist church it meets in. You know, but are we keeping our group business and club business separate? Open discussion meetings. You know, I think, and this is going to get maybe into a little bit of as Dave sees it. You know, I don't know, but I feel like, you know, we have a lot of problems, and we run around and we're swatting flies. We're going, well, he calls himself and a cross-dresser, and he does this and that, and we're talking about little things. And I'm more into looking at root cause of problems. And, you know, am I holding nothing but open discussion meetings where I welcome all, alcoholic or not, into my meeting? And then opening that meeting by saying, does anybody have a problem? And then do I in turn have a problem when a non-alcoholic shares a problem other than alcohol? Whose fault's that? Whose fault's that? You know, if I'm having that kind of problem, maybe I can reexamine the kind of meetings I'm attending, the kind of meetings I'm chairing, and see if something can be done differently there. You know, are we doing our best to limit it to sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of our 12 steps? And I know everybody's got groups that they want to run any way they want to, and that's fine. Like I said, that gets a little more into opinion, but I feel like that's one place we can take a look at it, because in history, open meetings had been for public information, and they were speaker meetings, and the public could come in, listen, and learn about alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous with hope of referring somebody to us, knowing a little bit about us. And somewhere along the line, especially during the 80s, we talked about, there grew a lot of open discussion meetings where it, you know, everybody come in and share. It's group therapy. You know, come on in and share. And is that what we want to be doing? I don't know. All right, what kind of things can we do to promote singleness of purpose? CPCPI, we're in a district meeting, so we ought to have all that here. One thing we got is there's an info on AA sheet that basically stresses our singleness of purpose, and it's a little information to those we approach on what Alcoholics Anonymous is and is not. And we can approach the people like judges that send people and all, and let them know the importance of identification in Alcoholics Anonymous, and let them know, you know, what closed meetings are, what open meetings are, and how to refer people to us, and why it's important. We don't go at them like they're trying to do something wrong. They don't know. You know, just try to share with them, you know, what our singleness of purpose is. Literature committee, what can you do? You know, you stock conference-approved literature of Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, best carries the message we wish to carry. You know, I'm careful not to carry non-Alcoholics Anonymous material right there as if it were the same thing. It's the best shot we got at, you know, seeing that it's carrying the message that AA as a whole, you know, wants carried. Treatment Facilities Committee, same kind of thing as CPC, going to the staff and letting them know about our singleness of purpose and how important that is. Another thing important, too, I've seen in some meetings is a lot of times you get in a meeting at a treatment facility and you realize, you know, it's mostly non-alcoholics in there, and you get a little uncomfortable. So you start sharing a little bit outside our singleness of purpose to make yourself more comfortable with the people you're sitting around. You need to limit the meetings we're carrying in there to recovery from alcoholism through 12 steps, you know. And it doesn't matter. If they're non-alcoholics there, they're visitors, and that's fine. But I need to limit my sharing to, you know, what we do. Or else I'm setting the guy up. He's going to come to meeting later thinking that's all right, and somebody's going to jump him, so I might as well let him know what AA is up front and all that and help him find where he needs to be. Corrections is the same kind of thing. Going to the warden, going to the staff, letting them know about this. They may insist on putting non-alcoholic visitors in. That's fine. But our meetings are to be conducted by the alcoholic members, the members of AA, whether they're inmates or whether they're outside people coming in, and we limit our discussion to alcoholism. We can do that in any situation, any facility. GSRs, another job, what kind of things can you do? You know, you're going to ensure that your group adheres to AA tradition. That means you're going to have to study them. You're going to have to know them and know the literature of AA, know the history of AA. You know where to go when these things come up, because they will. Make sure that you're holding regular group conscious meetings. Not just when they're a problem and not just about, you know, just business, spending the money, but, you know, to talk about how our group's doing. Are we doing what we want to do? What else we got? Groups. Bottom line, I think, is a need for strong, purposeful groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, are we doing all we can do? And if we feel like we might could do a little bit better, let's take a look at our groups. You know, let's try to have a strong group conscience. Let's get strong, qualified chair people for our meetings. You know, let's let them know what to do, not just say, oh, it's time to chair a meeting. here. You know, let's help them know what the group conscience is, if we have one, and help them to do the best job they can and back them up, because they're often in a hard position of having to stand on the group conscience, you know, and we got to back them up, let them know what that is. It's very helpful if we have a group conscience where we've decided how we handle problems ahead of time. You know, what are we going to do with this, that, and the other, so that we know ahead of time. And in fact, you know, and if we know ahead of time, it's helpful to read that group conscience statement up front. Because I can't call anybody down for doing something that they didn't know they shouldn't do. You know, and sometimes it's as simple as reading the blue card if we stick to it. More often than not, groups read it and then, you know, don't. But, you know, up front, have the group conscience statement up front, how we conduct our meeting. That's real helpful. Just take regular group inventory, you know, examine how we're doing and what we're doing, you know, how that's going. Are we studying the traditions in our group as well as the steps? You know, are we studying all this? Are we encouraging strong sponsorship, you know, in our groups? Sponsors, getting the sponsors, what can we do? Well, one thing we can do, the book asked me, you know, to qualify this guy. You know, if I'm working with a guy and I'm convinced he's alcoholic, I go on. If not, I try to help him find the help that's best for him, which isn't me. And I generally do that because I sponsor guys through the book, and we're reading doctor's opinion together, and I'm helping them find out if they have what we have, and if not, by God, I want them to find who can help them. And I'll do what I can. I'm not saying get out of AA. I'm wanting to help, and by taking you to those that can help you. And tell them about the importance of identification. You know, that being a standout in AA isn't necessarily a good thing, you know. But it's real helpful to start being part of the group. And some of that's as simple as how we identify ourselves in meetings and what we talk about. I talk to my guys about what we talk about in meetings. Because there are some things that are best between you and me. Meeting's not necessarily a fifth step. And not necessarily the place for a lot of other things that, you know, you hear discussed. And so I do that one-on-one with my guys and make sure we talk. And just individuals in general, you know, it gets a little tougher. You know, when you're sponsoring a guy, that's kind of easy. But individuals, you know, first thing we can do is be a strong example of Alcoholics Anonymous in action and principles of the steps and traditions in place. You know, I try to know where to get in touch with other fellowships in the area. I tend to carry my big book to a meeting. That's just me. But I also, in my big book, I carry a schedule for another fellowship because quite often that comes up, and I want to be helpful. The book says to be helpful is our only aim, and I'm not into, you know, get out. I'm into sit down, talk with you, and let's see if we can get you where you can find some help. And I find that's best to do one-on-one. It's not a one of us likes to be embarrassed in public, you know, and that is not real helpful. And I try to talk to somebody one-on-one. First thing I try to do is talk to them through their sponsor if I can. If they have a sponsor, you know, contact that person and say, hey, let's, you know, what can you do here? And that's usually helpful. But if I got to, talk to a person outside after a meeting. I don't scream at them across the room. I attend my group conscience meetings and I participate. You know, I care about how things are done in my groups. I'm there. I love guys in my group. Hell, we get 100% attendance nearly every time. They really care about what's going on in there. And you know, I just do the best I can to remember that not everybody here is in the right place, but not anybody here is here by accident. You know, that some people may need help of another fellowship. They may or may not have alcoholism, but they got here because somebody they trust referred them here. And so, you know, I'm going to kind of try and remember they're God's kids, and I'm not going to be unkind to people. I'm going to try and keep my 10-step inventory clean, you know, and do the thing I think God had had me do, and do the best I can. I'm going to defend Alcoholics Anonymous and traditions. I will do that. But I'm going to be kind in the process if I can, you know, and that's the thing we need to remember, that this isn't a stick to go beat people up with, but this is just hopefully how we're going to keep Alcoholics Anonymous here for your kids in case they need it and they have the same chance that you had. And I guess all I need to share on this, and we'll open up for a few minutes to talk if anybody's got any comments, questions, or anything like that.